Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. In his new book, Guns, Furs, and Gold, Larry Morris recounts the 19th century experience of the Arikawas, the Crows, Cheyennes, and Arapahos by detailing their interactions with four legendary survivors of a fight with the Arikaras in 1823. Trailblazer Jedediah Smith, interpreter Edward Rose, guide and Indian agent Thomas Fitzpatrick, and grizzly bear mauling survivor Hugh Glass. Their careers illuminate the fate of four Indian nations, revealing how, despite the best efforts of several explorers to treat indigenous peoples respectfully, the guns, furs, disease, and gold rushes of the interlopers put the Indians' way of life, their lands, and their very lives at grave risk. Larry E. Morris is an independent writer and historian. He's author of numerous books, including The Fate of the Corps, What Became of Lewis and Clark Explorers After the Expedition, which was a History Book Club selection, The Perilous West, Seven Amazing Explorers and Founding of the Oregon Trail, and In the Wake of Lewis and Clark, The Expedition and the Making of Antebellum America. Larry Morris, welcome to the program. Glad to have you with us.
Thanks very much.
So I mentioned those other books on Lewis and Clark. You begin this book with Lewis and Clark, then continue on. So that's about 1804 or so. End the book about 60 years later, 1864, the Sand Creek Massacre. What'd you want to accomplish with this book?
Wanted to tell especially the influence of Thomas Jefferson on the exploration of the West, and also how the explorers interacted with the Indians and what impact that had on the Indian nations.
So let's start there. So Thomas Jefferson, obviously, the core of discovery, that was the idea of Thomas Jefferson. But you talk a little bit in the book about, well, where did Thomas Jefferson get the idea?
He was very interested. You know, the interesting thing is he never did go west of Virginia or Washington, D.C., but from the start, he was extremely interested, and he started collecting books on what he called Louisiana. And when he was an ambassador in France, he collected, I think, 2,000 books of history, exploration. And so from the 1780s, he was very interested in organizing an expedition to explore what we call the Western United States. And he had great background in the history of the famous explorers like Magellan and Columbus. So he was very well versed in previous exploration, and he had read everything he possibly could on the early explorations of America, especially by the Spanish, of course.
Hmm. Now, this area already had explorers in it, right? The European Americans, obviously indigenous peoples, has been there for thousands of years. What was the effect on this fledgling nation, the United States? What was the effect back home of Lewis and Clark?
They, of course, were the first Americans to have an exploration all the way from the East Coast to the Pacific Coast. And it didn't, of course, it was newsworthy, but I don't think the significance of the exploration immediately became clear to the general population. At one point, you know, Lewis and Clark left the St. Louis area in the spring of 1804, and they did not return to St. Louis until September of 1806. And about halfway through that time period, there began to be rumors that Lewis and Clark had been killed or had been kidnapped by the Spanish who controlled the Mexico area. So there was quite a news bulletin when they reached St. Louis again in 1806. Lots of newspaper articles about that. But at that time, I don't think there was a realization of how the expedition would impact a Western expansion. Because as soon as they returned, fur traders started going west, following their route, and it didn't take long for the pioneers to follow that. But Western expansion took place much faster than Jefferson himself projected.
Well, I guess there are various reasons about why people would flood west, right? Economic, obviously, right? Fur trade,
you bet.
Make money, et cetera. Of course, here in Utah, we're very familiar with why the Latter-day Saints came, right? Right. So maybe talk a little bit about that. And you say, maybe emphasize that this was unexpected, at least to Jefferson. He didn't think this happened so fast and at such scale.
And it's good to know that Jefferson was interested in all kinds of things. He wanted Lewis and Clark to make notes of all the geological aspects of the West, the animals, and particularly he wanted to know about the Indians and their languages and their culture and their history. Lewis and Clark were investigating all of those subjects, and they were very good keeping records. But the main objective for Lewis and Clark, given to them by Jefferson, was to find a route to the Pacific Ocean for purposes of commerce. So business was number one. Just in the history of exploration generally, it has always been prompted by business or commerce concerns. Columbus, for example, he wanted to find a route to the Indies so they could, the Europeans could take advantage of all that was available in the Orient and in India. So it was based on business as well. And that was true of Lewis and Clark. And of course, the fur traders who came and did such great exploration, they were interested in business, and many of the pioneers who came were looking for land and for opportunities to earn a living for their family. And I think the freedom of the West had a great appeal, just as Kentucky did for Daniel Boone back in the 1700s. All that space and the freedom to go where you wanted to. But of course, a lot of times they were ignoring the fact that the area was already inhabited by Indians.
Mm-hmm. Well, I talk about the Indians, the indigenous people. So 1804, 1806, and then a few years following, what was the attitude of the indigenous peoples? I guess it may be as various as the peoples themselves, but, more and more people encroaching on their lands. What was the general attitude of indigenous peoples?
I think generally it was treated with a good deal of suspicion because there were so many people coming. And the even though the explorers did their best to treat the Indians respectfully, this was in the context of Thomas Jefferson and everyone else believing that the United States belonged to them. And when he sent Lewis and Clark out and they gave speeches to the Indians, they would call the Indians children, as if they were symbolic children of the leader, Jefferson. So they've immediately assumed that they have control and that the Indians are subordinate to them. So, of course, who wouldn't be suspicious of that kind of an attitude?
Now, of course,
However,
go ahead.
The Indians were interested, many of the nations were interested in trade possibilities with the Europeans. So they also had that interest in mind, same interest that Jefferson did, you know. And so as many of the Indian nations were friendly, such as the Mandans in North Dakota. That's where Lewis and Clark spent their first winter, and they got along fine. And they established good trade relations with several of these Indian nations. But there were some who were extremely hostile, the Blackfeet nation particularly, did not like the Europeans giving guns to their enemies. So it's a very complicated picture. But the Indian nations I deal with generally had pretty good relationships with the early explorers. But that changed as the gold rushes came, and there were just constant flow of pioneers going west, you know.
Of course, we have the benefit of hindsight, right? We know how this is going to turn out. But I wonder, the Western tribes could have, if they'd had communication with the Eastern Seaboard indigenous peoples, could have had an idea of how this might turn out, what the dangers were, right? I don't know if they had that kind of communication.
The interesting thing is, excuse me, the Indian nations themselves had been pushed west by other Indian nations before Lewis and Clark arrived on the scene. And so in that sense, they were used to migrating if they had problems with other Indian nations. A lot of the migration took place because of that. But there was a sort of balance among the Indian nations and a certain agreement, kind of a tacit agreement, that they had certain standards that they were living by. And they were pretty good at making peace after there had been a conflict. And you really didn't have one Indian nation that had a much higher technology and more guns and more people and that kind of thing, which is what happened when the Europeans started settling. So it was quite a different matter when the so-called Americans were coming west.
I want to... Well, first of all, anything else you'd like to say about Lewis and Clark before I jump ahead to the 1823 fight with the Iroquois?
Yes, I'd just like to mention that Lewis and Clark had pretty good relationships with the Indians. They did have one conflict, and that was with the Blackfeet, and it was kind of accidental because... Lewis was with just a few of his men, and he met some Blackfeet, had a good meeting, and then they camped together, and in the morning, one of those Indians grabbed one of the guns of Lewis and his men, and that's when a fight developed. Other than that, I think if Lewis had been more careful, he could have avoided that. But that was the one time where violence broke out and Lewis and his men killed two Blackfeet Indians. And from that time on, there was trouble with the Blackfeet Indians, quite understandably.
So let's talk about, Lewis and Clark, obviously, the first part of the book. Then you introduce us to some fascinating figures, both indigenous peoples and explorers. And it seems like all these explorers that we're going to meet in your book were, or at least most of them, were involved in this one fight with the Iroquois, 1823. So
yes.
this came about because of fur, right? There's a fur company. Ashley and Henry is incorporated.
That's right.
Led by Ashley. I can't remember his first name.
William.
William Ashley. By the way, I grew up in Vernal, Ashley Valley, and I believe that that this same man has given his name to Ashley Valley. Anyway, so William Ashley's leading this fur company, and they tell us a bit about this. 1823, they encounter the Aricara.
After Lewis and Clark, Manuel Lisa was a prominent fur trader in St. Louis, and he took a group west in 1807, the year right after Lewis and Clark, and he was doing pretty well in the fur trade at that time. And John Jacob Astor was the leading fur trader in the United States, and he was also making inroads around 1811. But all of that stopped with the War of 1812. And so that's when the fur trade really just stopped, because the Americans were so involved fighting the British. It really didn't get momentum again until the early 1820s. And that's when Ashley and Henry formed their company, 1822, and they were sending trappers up the Missouri River to establish fur trade with the Indians. And then, of course, the United States, those companies could make a huge profit if they were able to take furs from the Pacific coast over to China and back and forth with trade with China. So it was a big business and very competitive, and the main people that I deal with were employees of Ashley and Henry, and the Aricaras were in South Dakota, and they were kind of strategically located between other Indian nations. The Sioux Nation was very powerful. And they were south of the Aricara villages, and the Crow Indians were north. And so the Aricaras had great trade opportunities. And one reason the battle broke out was because they didn't feel they were being treated fairly, and they thought the American fur traders were bypassing them to go to their enemies and give their enemies guns and goods. So that's how that developed. And Ashley had two keel boats, and they were on their way up the Missouri River. They stopped to trade with the Aricaras, and everything seemed to be going fine. But one thing that the fur traders really didn't understand was that the Aricara villages there along the Missouri River in present South Dakota were not unified. They had quite a number of chiefs, and so it was possible for things to happen that some of the Aricaras didn't agree with. At any rate, the Aricaras, after they had obtained quite a few guns and ammunition from this group of traders, decided to attack, and the men that I deal with, Jedediah Smith and Thomas Fitzpatrick, Edward Rose, Hugh Glass, are the four main people. They were all on camped on a sandbar, taking care of horses they had obtained from the Aricaras when they were attacked, and the Indians were well protected by pickets, and they were on higher ground. So it was quite a violent battle, and several Americans were killed.
It's interesting. First of all, those horses were purchased by giving, I think, gunpowder to the Eric
That's
Russo.
correct.
Ironic
Yes.
that some of these men would be killed by those that very ammunition. The Indians apparently called out to some of their friends among those people on the sandbar.
Particularly Edward Rose.
Edward Rose, take care of
And
yourself, right? Yeah.
yes, that's right. He was a really interesting character. His father was white, and his mother was part African American and part Cherokee. So he had quite a friendly feeling toward the Indians. And he became fluent in both the Arikara and Crow languages and was a very popular interpreter. And that's why Ashley hired him, was because of his language skills. And he had lived among the Arikara, and before they attacked, they warned him to be careful. And even at that point, they had a good friendly relationship with him, you know. And he's the one, he was actually the previous night before the attack, he was in the Indian village and he came running down the shore, warning his companions that an attack was coming.
And Ashley apparently didn't believe this, right? He some stubbornness there.
That's right. And he thought he could keep things calm. So he didn't, he should have evacuated his men from that sandbar, but he didn't do it.
Let's take a brief break. When we come back, I want to have you tell me about these main explorers that you talk about, and some of the main figures among the indigenous peoples as well. The book is Guns, Furs, and Gold. The subtitle is An American West History of Indigenous Peoples and Explorers. The author is Larry E. Morris. He's with us for the hour. We'll have more following this break. Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We're talking with Larry Morris. He's the author most recently of Guns, Furs, and Gold, An American West History of Indigenous Peoples and Explorers. So, Larry Morris, I just want to read this paragraph from the book. You say, the hunters who survived the carnage that June morning, we're talking about that battle with the Arikara, had also made it through the Arikara War. They would play prominent roles in the history of the West, ushering in what one historian called the Era of Discovery, personified by the work of the Ashley men. We're talking about this Ashley and Henry company, who discovered or rediscovered, among other sites, South Pass, the Great Salt Lake, overland routes to California and Oregon. Indeed, the band stranded on that sandbar was arguably the most notable collection of mountaineers ever involved in a single chapter of fur trade. So before we get to some of these personalities, rediscovery of South Pass, of course, who discovered Great Salt Lake, overland routes to California, Oregon, obviously very influential in the, you know, the what would continue and increase as a flood of people coming west.
Yes. And for example, these Ashley men were very influential in the founding of the Oregon Trail. They were the first to explore that area, and then they served as guides for the pioneers who came west. And Jedediah Smith, for example, was the first American explorer to reach California from the east, the first to trek from San Diego to the Columbia River. And he helped make South Pass well known. South Pass is a place, just a plateau actually in Wyoming, where you cross the Continental Divide. On the east side, the water all flows into the Atlantic Ocean, and on the west side, the water all flows into the Pacific. And the early explorers had a hard time getting over the Continental Divide because they were in the mountains of Wyoming. And Lewis and Clark crossed the Continental Divide even farther north on what is now the Montana-Idaho border. But when John Jacob Astor's explorers discovered the South Pass in 1813, they knew they had an easy way to get across the Rocky Mountains. But that knowledge was basically lost in the confusion of the War of 1812. And Jedediah Smith and Thomas Fitzpatrick were the leaders of the group of Ashley men who rediscovered South Pass in 1824. And when you talk about the Mormon pioneers, for example, that's how they came west, was they all went across South Pass in Wyoming before they came down to Utah. So it was very influential.
So, I want to have you tell me about some of these figures. You've already talked about Edward Rose. A couple of these gentlemen have something in common. Hugh Glass and Jedediah Smith, both mauled by a grizzly bear. Not the same one, but let's start with Hugh Glass. Hugh Glass made famous with a couple of movies. Most recent one, The Revenant.
That's
Right.
right. He's a very interesting man. He was adopted by the Pawnee Indians, and he was said to be a pirate. We don't know if that's true or not. We don't have definite documents to support it. But in that attack of 1823, when there were several men killed, Hugh Glass wrote a very touching letter informing an elderly couple of their son's death. And that letter has been preserved, and it's become quite famous because Jedediah Smith was a religious man, and he said a prayer for these men who had been killed, and it's kind of considered the first Christian service in the Western United States. And Hugh Glass had some further adventures, and of course, the most famous one was when he was attacked by a grizzly bear, and he was with Henry and several of Henry's men, and this happened in South Dakota. And he was so badly injured that they couldn't transport him, and they assumed that he would die soon. And Henry left two men with him to bury him after he died. But eventually, he didn't die like they thought he would, but they thought he was about to die. And they took his gun and they left and made it back to the Missouri River and back to the fort. But Hugh Glass somehow survived. It's just an amazing story. And of course, it's depicted in The Revenant as well as a 1960s movie called Man in the Wilderness, starring Richard Harris. And those movies give a pretty good depiction of how he started eating berries and kind of took care of himself and managed to survive. He had to crawl quite a ways, and it was, but he did know the way. Because he was next to the Grand River, which flows into the Missouri, and these men knew the rivers so well, they could find their way by following rivers. And he survived, but in 1833, this would have been 9 years after the grizzly bear mauling, he was killed with three other men in an Indian battle.
You have a list of some other men here as well. You concentrated more on four of these, but a couple of these men, James Clyman, lived to 1881, a long life. There was another, Thomas Eddy, lived to 1891. Many of these died fairly, you know, somewhat young, but those two gentlemen lived long lives.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah.
It's quite a bit beyond the normal life expectancy for that era. And Thomas Eddy, for example, was the last of the survivors of the Henry and Ashley Man.
Mm-hmm. David Jackson, he gave his name to Jackson Hole and Jackson Lake, right? For
you
just
bet.
One thing in passing. Tell me about Jedediah Smith. I think we know generally, vaguely, a few things about Jedediah Smith. I did not know he also was mauled by a grizzly bear. You say that's maybe why he grew his hair long.
That's correct.
The bear had almost inhaled his entire head, right?
Yeah.
Badly damaged his ear. Jedediah Smith thereafter had missing one eyebrow. Anyway, tell us about this.
This was within months of the grizzly bear attack on Hugh Glass. Of course, Hugh Glass was in South Dakota, and Jedediah Smith was in Wyoming, but very similar circumstances. And he was injured, probably as bad as Hugh Glass was. But he did retained consciousness, and he asked James Clyman, who writes about this, he asked James Clyman to sew up his wounds, and he had needle and thread. And Clyman had never done anything like that before. But Jedediah Smith had the presence of mind that he told Clyman what to do. And so that was very important. The fact that he got stitches right on the scene. So different than Hugh Glass.
Mm.
And within a few days, he was pretty much back to normal. It's just unbelievable.
That is, yeah.
The injuries he must have had.
Mm-hmm.
And it was after that mauling that through help with the Crow Indians, Jedediah Smith and Thomas Fitzpatrick and their men found their way over South Pass, and they knew that they had crossed from the Pacific side of the divide to the Atlantic side. And so from that point on, it wasn't forgotten like it had been with John Jacob Astor's men. Now it became a regular route for the fur traders, and after that, of course, the pioneers who started coming in the 1830s.
Hmm. I want to read just your paragraph. You have little thumbnails on all these gentlemen. Jedediah Smith, explorer extraordinaire, the first to reach California from the east, first to trek from San Diego to the Columbia River. This is what really stood out to me. Devout shunner of the carnal life, but also a sometimes duplicitous negotiator, and you could go on to say rediscoverer of South Pass. He did have, I guess, religious impulse, Jedediah Smith.
Oh, yes. He's a very devout Christian and kind of shunned the drinking and some of the escapades of the explorers. He was very careful not to participate in those things, such as frequently there were Indian nations where the Indian women of that nation would be encouraged to have sexual relations with the explorers, and that happened a lot, but not with Jedediah Smith. And but in some of his dealings with the Indians, he really wasn't truthful.
Mm-hmm.
And that was also true of Lewis and Clark at times, too. Mm-hmm.
And you could say writ large, you know, many Indian agents, right, and the U.S. government, et cetera. Tell me, before we get to Thomas Fitzpatrick, the other of your, the fourth of your main four, tell us about some of the indigenous figures. Maybe you could tell me about Eagle Feather.
Eagle Feather was an Arikara chief who met Lewis and Clark when they were on their way west, as they were going upstream on the Missouri River. And he helped them. The Mandan Nation was north of the Arikaras. And one of the things Eagle Feather helped Lewis and Clark with was to establish good relationships with the Mandan people, who were sometimes at war with the Arikaras. But he was a very good diplomat, and he was quite knowledgeable about the geography of the area. And when Lewis and Clark, after they spent the winter in North Dakota, they sent some of their men back to Washington, D.C., and this group took Eagle Feather with them, as well as an interpreter, and they took other Indian chiefs as well, who were taken to the east, and they met Thomas Jefferson. And they had some very interesting episodes of seeing American cities and meeting politicians. But there was a real problem with taking these Indian chiefs east, was because they were so vulnerable to the diseases that the Americans had grown used to. And several chiefs died, and Eagle Feather was one of those who died in Washington.
Tell me, let's pause there. Tell me about that a little bit. There's a scene in your book. There's a boat going up. I think it's the Missouri River. One of the men gets smallpox. The captain is advised to just put him off, because that would mean his death. But he refuses. So this smallpox-laden boat is heading up the Missouri River. These smallpox especially just decimated some of these tribes, right?
Oh, yes. I have a chapter on how the you know, European diseases affected the Indians. And the first, of course, was smallpox. And smallpox, they had several epidemics in various parts of the world where thousands of people died. And one of those took place about the same time that Lewis and Clark were just young boys. So Lewis and Clark were well aware of the power of smallpox. But the incident that you mentioned was in the 1830s, and it was a trading boat heading up the Missouri River. But it wasn't smallpox, it was cholera in that case. And that was the second. Those were the two main diseases that affected the Indians so much. But as you said, every place they stopped as they went upriver, the cholera would spread. And that, a lot of Indians died in that epidemic.
I just have about 5 or 6 minutes left in the conversation. I want to make sure I get this, kind of the main themes in here. I want to read another paragraph from the book. This is from chapter four, end of chapter four. Although relegated to footnote status by some, the Arikara War, which we mentioned earlier, was a powerful portent of things to come, a watershed encounter highlighting perennial misunderstandings between Indians and European Americans. Ashley's trappers could not fathom an Arikara culture that reverenced Mother Corn, for example. Intertribal commerce and welfare were all key parts of warfare, rather, were key parts of the story, as well as the pox transmitted by interlopers. Moreover, the conflict ushered in the fur trade rendezvous era and opened the way for a flood of missionaries, homesteaders, and gold seekers storming westward over the Indian lands in the 1830s, 40s, and 50s. As one historian has written, contact established by Lewis and Clark was both the beginning and the end of the world for the upper Missouri River peoples. you know, tragic in the end. I want to, you end the book with a culminating massacre, right? Sand Creek.
Yes.
Tell me about that. Here, we just have 2 or 3 minutes left. This is, you know, it's tragic, but it kind of sums up the end. What began in 1804, right? Now 60 years later.
Yes. Kind of a sad ending of that 60 years. And two of the main Indian nations I deal with are the Cheyenne and the Arapaho. And by the 1850s, many of them had settled in Colorado. And Fitzpatrick got along very well with those nations, and he was the Indian first an explorer, later an Indian agent, but he died in the early 1850s. And shortly after his, not just a few years after his death, there was the Colorado Gold Rush. So you had many people coming from the east for the Gold Rush and just trespassing on Indian land. Just terrible. Even though they were peaceful and they were doing their best, conflicts were inevitable. But there was a group of Arapaho and Cheyenne chiefs who were quite, tried to maintain peace. But when conflict broke out, this Colonel Shivington, who was a U.S. Army captain, took a very extreme approach to the problems. And he and his men, even though it was a peaceful group, they attacked a village of probably 200 Indians and killed many of them, probably a majority of them, and many of those who died were elderly or women and children. Mm. And it was just a very sad ending to the explorers' relationships with the Indians.
One little tidbit I took from this, that Colonel Chivington apparently had been a minister.
That's correct.
Before he joined the Army, I guess. I guess in his mind, he could square all this. Just about a minute left. What's your big takeaway? What would you have people take away from this discussion?
Well, I think the Indian named Friday is a good example of that. And Thomas Fitzpatrick was on the Santa Fe Trail on his way to New Mexico when he discovered a young Indian boy who was lost, and they couldn't find his family, and Fitzpatrick adopted him. And eventually his family was found and he returned to it, but he was educated by Fitzpatrick and became a great interpreter and a great diplomat for the Arapaho Nation. And even though he had friends that were killed at some of these massacres, he stayed peaceful and did his best to establish friendly relations between the Indians and the Americans. And one of his most memorable meetings was with the President Hayes when they were establishing a peaceful Indian reservation in Wyoming. Mm. And so even though there were tragedies, this Arapaho Indian, we still call him Friday, was a great peace diplomat and a good example of somebody who came through difficult circumstances.
We'll leave it there. You'll have to read the rest in the book. The book is out and available. It's called Guns, Furs, and Gold. Subtitle is An American West History of Indigenous Peoples and Explorers. And the author, Larry E. Morris, has been with us. Larry Morris, a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. And thanks, everyone, for listening to Access Utah.
Skywatcher Leo T here, where it's one sky, many cultures. This is a special edition on the facets of a fascinating Plains Native American tribe called the Skeetie, which have a history and background tied to the Pawnee people, but were also independent of them as well. And let the cat in. Come on, you want to come in? Nope? Okay. Don Madison of Cody, Wyoming's enthusiasm, historical, cultural, and celestial interest with the Skeetie Pawnee, as well as research of charts and interpretation of Skeetie art through his own art, have sparked this episode with possibly some more to follow. The Skeetie is one of four bands of Pawnee people. They lived on the central plains of Nebraska and Kansas for most of the millennium prior to European contact. The Skeetie, also known as the Wolf Band, lived in the northern part of Pawnee territory. In the 18th century, the Skeetie first lived on the Loup River in Nebraska. Their main territory was Nebraska, Kansas, and parts of South Dakota, but they stuck close to the Platte River when they migrated. See the map on the Skywatcher Leo T. Facebook page, as well as, of course, fascinating photos of these fine people. This background from Anthony Aveni, Star Stories of Constellations and People, is the name of his book. While many cultures live in housing that aren't coordinated with the rest of the solar system, the Skeetie Pawnee and Lakota sought a grander connection to the cosmos when they designed their homes and community buildings. In fact, they patterned entire villages and landmarks after the positions of the constellations. One of their myths tells of the stars originally being brought to Earth. They established the locations of their camps. The Skeetie assigned each village a patron star and made the villagers responsible for conducting rites tied to this. For example, ceremonies at the shrine of the village farthest to the west, under Tirawa, god of life and knowledge, were the first in the seasonal calendar to be performed. The initial rite, first thunder ceremony, happened when springtime thunder was first heard. Around the time of the equinox, the four bowl stars of the Big Dipper, which pivot around the North Star, mapped out positions of the five central villages on the ground relative to the center. Actually, Don Madison's research of the Skeetie by many people.
Yeah, it's just those guys built their lodges to line up with the shortest and the longest days of the year, and they made the smoke hole so certain stars would show up at certain times of the year, and they were especially fascinated with the way Mars got close to the Pleiades, and when that happened, it started this series of rituals, and so their lodges and their life was tied to the stars, and so their and all their religious beliefs were tied to the stars, and I just think that would be a very cool way to go about living, you know, is to pay attention to something so real, you know, make plans for when they planted, when they hunted, and a lot of the rituals that they did.
Let's check out the Skeetie celestial story. In Skeetie cosmology, their favorite morning star for a specific ceremony when it's in the morning is Mars, red and powerful. As you know, Mars is not always the morning star, and neither is Venus or Jupiter or Saturn, but they take turns. Mars, a male star being, a bringer of life, renewal, and sacred fire. Their favorite evening star, when it is in the evening, is Venus, a female star being soft and white, associated with earth, fertility, water, and creation. The Pleiades, or Seven Sisters, were often seen as the children of the evening star or the maidens protected by her when morning star or Mars appeared near the Pleiades in the sky. It is indicated that the morning star Mars was approaching the daughters of the evening star. Stuff started happening, signaling a cosmic union and renewal of the world. This was celestial union, like day touching night, fire touching water, sky touching earth. The Pawnee saw it as if the heavens were reenacting the first moments of creation. The Skeetie origin myth says long ago the Sky People created the world by working together in harmony, but the world remained incomplete. So Morning Star, the red powerful star, crossed the heavens to seek the help of Evening Star, who guarded the powers of life. The union of these two star beings brought lightning, fire, the first dawn, the first people, and this celestial marriage was not physical, but cosmic. One of the big rituals Skeetie honored was the Morning Star Ceremony, which happened every 780 days. That's how long it takes for this conjunction to happen. The Morning Star Ritual, the Skeetie created lodges that were aligned with the smoke hole to show the Pleiades and Mars in the same view, a sign to them that it was time for the Morning Star Ritual. Mars appeared as an early morning star, rising in the east before the sun when it occupied a position relative to the Seven Sisters. Many preparations and ceremonies celebrating the Skeetie Pawnee connection to the earth and thanking the star beings were conducted. And Don Madison has interpreted a painting and rendering on buckskin as he celebrates the Skeetie individual who's given credit for stopping a brutal practice of human sacrifice in 1838. Don has created a respectful star field rendering on deer skin, showing the Pleiades on one side of the dark buckskin and Mars on the other, with the portrait of Petalasharo. Petalasharo, circulation 1797 to 1832, a Skeedy Pawnee painted by Charles Bird King in 1822. Don will donate some of the proceeds from the sales to the Skeedy Pawnee to the Pawnee Mental Health Foundation. See the Skywatcher Leo T. Facebook page for this artistic interpretation of Petalasharo, originally by Charles Bird, and other great photos, as well as how they set up their lodges in respect to the universe. To look at Don Matteson's interpretation, that is Don Matteson, M-A-T-T-E-S-O-N. Facebook name is Wyoming Creations. You can look on Etsy. The name is Matteson, Y-O Creations. Or you can look at the website, which is wyomingcreations.com. So keep looking up, look around, and get just a little bit lost in space and time. Skywatcher Leo T.